How's it coming? I shrugged. So far, there's nothing but junk. I went back to the masses of paper in front of me. Too bad you weren't in charge of the bills, I remarked.
I'm not good with numbers. I hated high school math, she said. And then after a moment, I'm beginning to feel guilty having you snoop through his things.
Don't worry about it. I do this for a living. I'm a diagnostician, like a gynecologist when you have your feet in the stirrups and your fanny in the air. My interest isn't personal. I simply look to see what's there.
He was a good man. I know that.
I'm sure he was, I said. This may net us nothing, and if so, you'll feel better. You're entitled to peace.
Do you need help?
Not really. At this point, I'm still picking my way through. Anyway, I'm about to wrap it up for this afternoon. I'll come back tomorrow and take another run at it. I jammed a fistful of catalogs and advertising flyers in the trash bag. I glanced up again, aware that she was still standing in the door.
Could you join me for supper? Brant's going to be working, so it would just be the two of us.
I'd better not, but thanks. Maybe tomorrow. I have some phone calls to make, and then I thought I'd grab a quick bite and make an early night of it. I should finish this in the morning. At some point, we'll have telephone records to go through. That's a big undertaking, and I'm saving it for last. We'll sit side by side and see how many phone numbers you can recognize.
Well, she said reluctantly, I'll let you get back to work.
When I had finished for the day, Selma gave me a house key, though she assured me she generally left the doors unlocked. She told me she was often gone, but she wanted me to have the run of the place in her absence. I told her I'd want to look through Tom's personal effects, and she had no objections. I didn't want her walking in one day to find me poking through his clothes. It was fully dark when I left, and the streetlights did little to dispel the sense of isolation. The traffic through town was lively. People were going home to dinner. Businesses were shutting down. Restaurants were getting busy, the bar doors standing open to release the excess noise and cigarette smoke. A few hardy joggers had hit the sidewalks, along with assorted dog owners whose charges were seeking relief against the shrubs. Once I was out on the highway, I became aware of the vast tracts of land that bore no evidence of human habitation. By day, the fences and the odd outbuildings created the impression the countryside had been civilized. At night, the mountain ranges were as black as jet, and the pale slice of moon scarcely brushed the snowy peaks with silver. The temperature had dropped, and I could smell the inky damp of the lake. I felt a flicker of longing to see Santa Teresa with its red tile roofs, palm trees, and the thundering Pacific. I slowed when I saw the sign for Nota Lake Cabins. Maybe a crackling fire and a hot shower would cheer me up. I parked my car in the small lot near the motel office. Cecilia Bowden had provided a few low-voltage lights along the path to the cabins, small mushroom shapes that cast a circle of dim yellow on the cedar chips. There was a small lighted lamp mounted by the cabin door. I hadn't left any lights on for myself, sensing perhaps that the management would frown on such extravagance. I unlocked the door and let myself in, feeling for the light switch. The overhead bulb came on with its flat 40-watt wash of light. I crossed to the bed and clicked on the table lamp, which offered 40 watts more. The digital alarm was flashing 12 o'clock repeatedly, which suggested a minor power outage earlier. I checked my watch and corrected the time to its current state, 6:22. The room felt drab and chilly. There was a strong smell of old wood fires and moisture seeping through the floorboards from underneath the cabin. I checked the wood in the grate. There was a stack of newspapers close by meant for kindling. Of course, there was no gas starter, and I suspected the fire would take more time to light than I had time to enjoy. I went around the room, closing cotton curtains across the window panes. Then I peeled off my clothes and stepped into the shower. I'm not one to waste water, but even so, the hot began to diminish before my 4 minutes were up. I rinsed the last of the shampoo from my hair a split second before the cold water descended full force. This was beginning to feel like a wilderness experience. Dressed again, I locked the cabin and headed back toward the road, walking briskly along the berm until I reached the restaurant. The Rainbow Cafe was about the size of a double-wide trailer,
with a formica counter with 8 stools running down its length and 8 red naugahyde booths arranged along 2 walls. There was 1 wait person, female, 1 short order cook, also female, and a boy bus person in evidence. I ordered breakfast for dinner. There's nothing so comforting as scrambled eggs at night. Soft, cheery yellow, bright with butter, flecked with pepper. I had 3 strips of crisp bacon, a pile of hash browns sautéed with onion, and 2 pieces of rye toast, drenched in butter and dripping with jam. I nearly crooned aloud as the flavors blended in my mouth. On the way back to my cabin, I paused to use the payphone outside the office. This consisted of an old-fashioned glass and metal phone booth, missing the original bifold door. I used my credit card to call Dietz. "Hey, babe, how's the patient?" I said when he answered.
"Dandy. How are you?"
"Not bad. Now on retainer."
"In Nodal Lake?"
"Where else? Standing in a phone booth in the piney woods," I said.
"How's it going?"
"I'm just getting started, so it's hard to tell. I'm assuming Selma talked to you about Tom."
"Only that she thought he had something on his mind. Sounds vague."
"Extremely. Did you ever meet him yourself?"
"Nope. In fact, I haven't even seen her for over 15 years. How's she holding up?"
"She's in good shape. Upset, as who wouldn't be in her shoes?"
"What's the game plan?" he asked.
"The usual. I spent time today going through his desk. Tomorrow I'll start talking to his friends and acquaintances, and we'll see what develops. I'll give it until Thursday and then see where we stand. I'd love to be home by the weekend if this job doesn't pan out." "How's the knee?"
"Much better. The PT's a bitch, but I'm getting used to it. I miss your sandwiches."
"Liar."
"No, I'm serious. As soon as you finish there, I think you ought to head back in this direction."
"Uh-uh. No thanks. I want to sleep in my own bed. I haven't seen Henry for a month." Henry Pitts was my landlord, 86 years old. His would be the cover photo if the AARP ever did a calendar of octogenarian hunks.
"Well, think on it," Deet said.
"Oh, right. Listen, my Florence Nightingale days are over. I have a business to run. Anyway, I better go. It's friggin' cold out here."
"I'll let you go, then. Take care."
"Same to you," I said. I put a call through to Henry and caught him on his way out the door. "Where are you off to?" I asked.
"I'm on my way to Rosie's. She and William need help with the dinner crowd tonight," he said.
Rosie ran the tavern half a block from my apartment. She and Henry's older brother William had been married the previous Thanksgiving, and now William was rapidly becoming a restaurateur.
"What about you? Where are you calling from?"
I repeated my tale, filling him in on my current situation. I gave him both Selma's home number and that of the office at the Nodal Lake Cabins, in case he had to reach me. We continued to chat briefly before he had to go. Once he rang off, I placed a call to Lonnie's office and left a message for Ida Ruth, again giving her my location and Selma's number, if she should have to reach me for some reason. I couldn't think of any other way to feel connected. After I hung up, I stuck my hands in my jacket pockets, vainly hoping for shelter from the wind. The notion of spending the evening in the cabin seemed depressing. With only 2 40-watt light bulbs for illumination, even reading would be a chore. I pictured myself huddled, squinting under that damp-looking quilt, spiders creeping from the woodpile the minute I relaxed my vigilance. It was a sorry prospect, given that all I had with me was a book on identifying tire tracks and tread marks. I crossed to the motel office and peered in through the glass door.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
I crossed to the motel office and peered in through the glass door. A light was on, but there was no sign of Cecilia. A hand-lettered sign said, "Ring for MGR." I let myself in. I bypassed the desk bell and knocked on the door marked manager. After a moment, Cecilia appeared in a pink chenille bathrobe and fluffy pink slippers.
"Yes?"
"Hi, Cecilia. Could I have a word with you?"
"Something's wrong with the room?"
"Not at all. Everything's fine. More or less. I was wondering if you could spare a few minutes to talk about your brother."
"What about him?"
Has Selma said anything about why I'm here in Noda Lake?
Said she hired you is all. I don't even know what you do for a living.
Ah, well, actually I'm a field investigator with California Fidelity Insurance. Selma's concerned about the liability in Tom's death.
Liability for what?
Good question. Of course, I'm not at liberty to discuss this in any detail. You know, officially he wasn't working, but she thinks he might have been pursuing departmental business the night he died. If so, it's always possible she can file a claim. I didn't mention that Tom Newquist wasn't represented by CFI, or that the company had fired me approximately 18 months before. I was prepared to flash the laminated picture ID I still had in my possession. The CFI logo was emblazoned on the front, along with a photograph of me that looked like something the Border Patrol might keep posted for ready reference. She stared at me blankly, and for one heart-stopping moment, I wondered if she was recently retired from some obscure branch of county government. She appeared to be mulling over all the rules and regulations, trying to decide which were in effect on the night in question. I was tempted to embellish, but decided I might be getting in too deep. With lies, it's best to skip across the surface like a dragonfly. The more said at the outset, the more there is to retract later if it turns out you really put your foot in it. She held the door open to admit me.
You better come on in. I don't mind telling you, the subject's painful.
I can imagine it is, and I'm sorry to intrude. I met Macon earlier.
He's useless, she remarked. No love lost between us. Of course, I never thought of Selma as family either, and I'm sure it's ditto from her perspective.
Cecilia Bowden's apartment was on a par with my cabin, which is to say, drab, poorly lighted, and faintly shabby. The prime difference was that my place was icy cold, where she seemed to keep her room temperature somewhere around pre-heat. The floor cover was linoleum made to look like wood parquet. She had pine-paneled walls, overstuffed furniture covered with violent colored crocheted throws. A large television set dominated one corner, with all the furniture oriented in that direction. Cecilia's reading glasses were perched on the arm of the sofa nearest the set. I could see that she was in the process of filling out the crossword puzzle in the local paper. She did this in ballpoint pen, without any visible corrections. I revised my estimate of her upwards. I couldn't perform such a feat with a gun to my head. We took a few minutes to get settled in the living room. While my story sounded plausible, it didn't give me much room to inquire into Tom's character. In any event, why would I imagine Cecilia would have information about what he was doing the night he died? As it turned out, she didn't question my purpose, and the longer we chatted, the clearer it became that she was perfectly comfortable discussing Tom and his wife, their marriage, and anything else I cared to ask about. Selma says Tom was preoccupied with something in the past few weeks. Do you have any idea what it might have been? Cecilia narrowed her eyes at the section of floor she was studying.
What makes her think there was anything wrong with him?
Well, I'm not sure. She said he seemed tense, smoking more than usual, and she thought he was losing weight. She said he slept poorly and disappeared without explanation. I take it this wasn't typical. Did he say anything to you?
He didn't confide anything specific, she said cautiously. You'll have to talk to Macon about that. They were a lot closer to each other than either one of them was to me.
But what was your impression? Did you feel he was under some kind of strain?
Possibly.
Too bad I wasn't taking notes, what with the wealth of data pouring out. Did you ever ask him about it?
I didn't feel it was my place. That wasn't the nature of our relationship. He went about his business and I went about mine.
Any hunches about what was going on? She hesitated for a moment.
I think Tom was unhappy. He never said as much to me, but that's my belief.
I made a sort of mmm sound, verbal filler accompanied by what I hoped was a sympathetic look. She took this for encouragement and launched into her analysis.
Far be it from me to criticize Selma. He married her, I didn't. It's possible there was more to her than meets the eye. We'd certainly have to hope so. If you want my opinion, My brother could have done a lot better for himself. Selma's a snob, if you want to know the truth.
This time I murmured, "Really?" Her gaze brushed my face and then drifted off again.
You look like a good judge of character, so I don't feel I'm telling tales out of school when I say this. She has no spiritual foundation, even if she does go to church. She's a mite materialistic. She seems to think she can use acquisitions to fill the void in her life, but it won't do.
For example, I said,
You saw the new carpet in the living room?
Yes, I saw that. Cecilia shot me a glance filled with satisfaction.
She had that installed about 10 days ago. I thought it was in poor taste, doing it so soon, but Selma never asked me. Selma's also confided she's considering having those 2 front teeth capped, which is not only vain, but completely trivial. Talk about a waste of money. I guess now she's a widow, she can do anything she likes.
What I thought was, what's wrong with vanity? Given the range of human failings, self-absorption is harmless compared to some I could name. Why not do whatever you deem relevant to feeling better about yourself? Within reason, of course. If Selma wanted to get her teeth capped, why should Cecilia give a shit? What I said was, I got the impression she was devoted to Tom.
As well she should have been, and he to her, I might add. Tom spent his life trying to satisfy the woman. If it wasn't one thing, it was another. First she had to have a house. Then she wanted something bigger in a better neighborhood. Then they had to join the country club. And on it went. Any time she didn't get what she wanted? Well, she pouted and sulked until he broke down and got it for her. It was pitiful, in my opinion. Tom did everything he could, but there wasn't any way to make her happy.
I said, My goodness. This is the way I talk in situations like this. I could not, for the life of me, think where to go from here. He was a nice-looking man. I saw a picture of him at the house, I said, vamping.
He was downright handsome. Why he married Selma was a mystery to me. And that son of hers?
Cecilia pulled her lips together like a drawstring purse.
Brant was a pain in the grits from the first time I ever laid eyes on the boy. He had a mouth on him like a trucker, and he was bratty to boot. Back talk and sass? You never heard the like. Did poorly in school, too. Problems with his temper and what they call his impulse control. Of course, Selma thought he was a saint. She wouldn't tolerate a word of criticism regardless of what he did. Poor Tom nearly tore his hair out. I guess he finally managed to get the boy squared away, but it was no thanks to her.
She mentioned Brant worked as a paramedic. That's a responsible job.
Well, that's true enough, she conceded grudgingly. About time he took hold. You can credit Tom for that.
Do you happen to know where Tom was going that night? I understand he was found somewhere on the outskirts of town.
1 mile north of here.
He didn't drop in to see you?
I wish he had, she said. I was visiting a friend down in Independence and didn't get back here until shortly after 10 o'clock. I saw the ambulance pass, but I had no idea it was meant for him.
Chapter 4 Tuesday morning at 9, I stopped by the offices of the Nota County Coroner. I hadn't slept well the night before. The cabin was poorly insulated, and the night air was frigid. I'd moved the thermostat up to 70, but all it did was click off and on ineffectually. I'd crawled into bed wearing my sweats, a turtleneck, and a pair of heavy socks. The mattress was as turgid as a trough of mud. I curled up under a comforter, a quilt, and a wool blanket, with my heavy leather jacket piled on top for the weight. Just about the time I got warm, my bladder announced that it was filled to capacity and required my immediate attention, or a bout of bedwetting would ensue. I tried to ignore the discomfort, and then realized I'd never sleep a wink until I'd heeded the message. By the time I got back under the covers, all the ambient heat had been dispelled, and I was forced to suffer through the cold again until I drifted off to sleep. When I woke up at 7, my nose felt like a popsicle, and my breath was visible in puffs against the wan morning light. I showered in tepid water, dried myself shivering, and dressed in haste. Then I dog-trotted down the road to the Rainbow Cafe, where I stoked up on another breakfast, sucking down orange juice, coffee, sausages, and pancakes saturated with butter and syrup. I told myself I needed all the sugar and fat to refuel my depleted reserves. But the truth was, I felt sorry for myself, and the food was the simplest form of consolation. The coroner's office was located on a side street in the heart of the downtown. In Nota County, the coroner is a 4-year elected official, who in this case doubled as the funeral director for the county's only mortuary. Nota County is small, less than 2,000 square miles, tucked like an afterthought between Inyo and Mono counties. The coroner, Wilton Kirchner III, generally referred to as Trey, had occupied the position for the past 10 years. Since there was no requirement for formal training in forensic medicine, all coroner's cases were autopsied by a forensic pathologist under contract to the county. In the event of a homicide in the county, the Nota County coroner handles the on-scene investigation in conjunction with the sheriff's department's investigator and an investigator from the Nota County District Attorney's Office. The forensic autopsy is then conducted in the big city by a pathologist who does several homicide autopsies per month and is called to court numerous times during the year to testify. Since Nota County only has one homicide every 2 years or so, the coroner prefers that an outside agency provide its expertise in both autopsy services and testimony. Kirchner and Son's mortuary appeared to have been a private residence at one time, probably built in the early 20s with the town growing up around it. The architectural style was Tudor, with a facade of pale red brick trimmed in dark painted timbers. Thin, cold sunlight glittered against the leaded glass windows. The surrounding lawns were dormant, the grass as drab and brittle as brown plastic. Only the holly bushes lent any color to the landscape. I could imagine a time when the house might have sat on a sizable piece of land, but now the property had shrunk, and the lots on either side sported commercial establishments, a real estate office, and a modest medical complex. Trey Kirchner came out to the reception area when he heard I was there, extending a hand in greeting as he introduced himself. "Trey Kirchner," he said. "Selma called and said you'd be in here today. Nice to meet you, Miss Milhone. Come on back to my office and let's find out what you need." Kirchner was in his mid-50s, tall, broad-shouldered, with a waistline only slightly softer than it might have been 10 years before. His hair was a clean gray, parted on the side and trimmed short around his ears. His smile was pleasant, creating concentric creases on either side of his mouth. He wore glasses with large lenses and thin metal frames. The corners of his eyes drooped slightly, somehow creating an expression of immense sympathy. His suit was close-fitting, well-pressed, and the dress shirt he wore looked freshly starched. His tie was conservative, but not somber. Altogether, he presented an air of comforting competence. There was something solid about him, a man who by nature looked like he could absorb all the sorrow, confusion, and rage generated by death. I followed him down a long corridor and into his office, which had served as the dining room when the house was first built. The carpet was pale, the wood floors pickled to the color of milk-washed pine. The drapes were beige, silk or shantung, some fabric with a touch of sheen. The mortuary decor leaned to wainscoting, topped with wallpaper murals showing soft mountain landscapes, forests of evergreens with paths meandering through the woods. This was a watercolor world, pastel skies piled with clouds, the faintest suggestion of a breeze touching the tips of the wallpaper trees. On either side of the corridor, at intervals, wide sliding doors had been pushed back to reveal the slumber rooms, empty of inhabitants, bare except for the ranks of gray metal folding chairs and a few potted ferns. The air was cool, underheated, spiced with the scent of carnations, though none were in view. Perhaps it was some weird form of mortuary air freshener wafting through the vents. The entire environment seemed geared to somnambulistic calm. The office we entered seemed designed for the public. Not a book, a file, or a piece of paper in sight. I suspected somewhere in the building, Trey Kirchner had an office where the real work was done. Somewhere out of sight, too, was the autopsy paraphernalia. Cameras, X-ray equipment, stainless steel table,
Striker saw, scalpels, hanging scale. The room where we sat was as bland as a pudding. No smell of formalin, no murky mason jars filled with snippets of organs, giving no indication of the mechanics of the body's preparation for cremation or burial. "Have a seat," he said, indicating two matching upholstered chairs arranged on either side of a small side table. His manner was relaxed, pleasant, friendly, curiously impersonal.
"I take it you're here about Tom's death."
He reached over and opened the drawer, pulling out a flat manila folder containing a 5-page report.
"I ran a copy of the autopsy report in case you're interested."
I took the folder. "Thanks. I thought I might have to talk you into this." He smiled.
"It's public record. I could have popped it in the mail and saved you a trip if Selma'd asked for it sooner."
"Tom's death was classified as a coroner's case?"
"Of necessity," he said. "You know, he died out on Highway 395 with no witnesses, and probably not much warning. He hadn't seen his doctor in close to a year. We figured it was his heart, but you never really know about these things until the post. Could have been an aneurysm. Anyway, Calvin Berkey did the autopsy. He's the forensic pathologist for Nota and Mono counties. Couple of us in attendance. Nothing remarkable showed up. No surprises, nothing unexpected. Tom died of a massive acute myocardial infarction due to severe arterial sclerosis. You'll see it. It's all there. Sections of the coronary artery, confirmed 95% to 100% occlusion. 63 years old. Really, it's amazing he lasted as long as he did.
Nothing else came to light?
In the way of abnormalities? Nope. Liver, gallbladder, spleen, kidneys were all unremarkable. Lungs looked bad. He'd been smoking all his life, but there was no indication of invasive disease. He'd eaten recently. According to our report, he'd stopped off at a cafe for a bite of supper. No pills or capsules in his digestive system, and the toxi report was clear. What makes you ask?
Selma said he'd been losing weight. I wondered if he knew something he wasn't telling her.
No, ma'am. No cancer, if that's what you mean. No tumors, no blood clots, no hemorrhaging, aside from the myocardium, he said. Doc said there were signs of a minor heart attack sometime in the past.
I thought about it. So maybe he knew his days were numbered. That would give him reason to brood.
Could be, he said. Tom wasn't in the peak of health, I can assure you of that. The absence of pathology doesn't necessarily mean you feel all that good. I knew him for years and never heard him complain, but he was 60 pounds overweight. Smoked like a chimney, drank like a fish, just to cover both clichés. He was a hell of an investigator, I can tell you that. What's Selma's worry?
It's hard to say. I think she feels he was holding out on her, keeping secrets of some kind. She didn't press him for answers, so now it's unfinished business, and it bothers her a lot.
And she has no idea what it was?
It might not be anything, which is where I come in. Do you have any theories?
I don't think you'll turn up anything scandalous. Tom was church-going, a good soul. Well-liked, well-thought-of in the community, generous with his time. If he had any faults, I'd have to say he was straight-laced, too rigid. He saw the world in terms of all black or all white, with not a lot in between. I guess he could see the gray, but he never knew what to do with it. He didn't believe in bending the rules, though I've seen him do it from time to time. He was a real straight-ahead guy, but that's good in my opinion. We could use a few more like him. We're going to miss him around here.
Did you spend any time with him in the past few weeks?
Nothing to speak of. Mostly I saw him in the context of his job. Not surprisingly, the county sheriff's department and the coroner's office are just like that,
he said, crossing his fingers.
I'd run into him around town, play pool with him once, suck back a few beers. Bunch of us did a weekend fishing trip last fall, but it's not like we laid around at night baring our souls. Fella you ought to talk to is his partner, Rafe.
Selma mentioned him. What's his last name?
Lamotte.
I sat in the rental car in the Kirchner & Sons parking lot, leafing through Tom Newquist's autopsy report, his death certificate spelling out the particulars of his passing. Age, date of birth, social security number, and his usual address. The place and cause of his death and the disposition of his remains. He'd arrived at Nota County Hospital ER as a DOA, autopsied a day later, buried the day after that. On paper, his progression to the grave seemed all too swift, but in truth, once death occurs, the human body is just a big piece of meat quickly going sour.
There was something flat and abrupt in the details. Tom Newquist, deceased. His life neatly packaged, beginning, middle, and end. Under the death certificate was a copy of a hand-scrawled note that I gathered had been written by the CHP officer who found him in his truck. At approximately 21:50, two-thirds, ambulance call to roadside, 7.2 miles out Highway 395. Subject in pickup removed to side of road. CPR started at 2200. EMT from Noda Lake taking over at approximately 2210. Subject DOA on arrival at Noda Lake ER. Coroner notified. The notation was signed J. Tennyson. The autopsy report followed. Three typewritten pages detailing the facts, as Trey Kirchner had indicated. I'd been hoping the explanation was obvious, that Tom Newquist was caught in the grip of some terminal disease, his preoccupation as simple as an intimation of his mortality. This was not the case. If Selma's perceptions were correct, and he was brooding about something, the subject wasn't an immediate threat to his health or well-being. It was always possible he'd been experiencing heart problems, angina pain, arrhythmia, shortness of breath on exertion. If so, he might have been weighing the severity of his symptoms against the consequences of consulting his physician. Tom Newquist might have seen enough death to view the process philosophically. He might have been more fearful of medical intervention than the possibility of dying. I set the folder on the seat beside me and started the car. I wasn't sure where to go next, but I suspected the logical move would be to talk to Tom's partner, Rafer Lamott. I checked my map of Noda Lake and spotted the sheriff's substation, which was part of the Civic Center on Benoit, about 6 blocks west. The sun had been climbing through a thin layer of clouds. The air was chilly, but there was something lovely about the light. Along the main thoroughfare, the buildings were constructed of stucco and wood with corrugated metal roofs. Gas stations, a drugstore, a sporting goods shop, and hair salon. Rimming the town was the untouched beauty of distant mountains. The digital thermometer on the bank sign showed that it was 42 degrees. I parked across the street from the Noda Lake Civic Center, which also included the police station, the county courthouse, and assorted community services. The complex of administrative offices was housed in a building that had once been an elementary school. I know this because the words, Noda Lake Grammar School, were carved in block letters on the architrave. I could have sworn I could still see the faint imprint of construction paper witches and pumpkins where they'd been affixed to the windows with cellophane tape, the ghosts of Halloween's past. Personally, I hated grade school, having been cursed with a curious combination of timidity and rebellion. School was a minefield of unwritten rules that everyone but me seemed to sense and accept. My parents had died in a car crash when I was 5, so school felt like a continuation of the same villainy and betrayal. I was inclined to upchuck without provocation, which didn't endear me to the janitor or classmate sitting in my vicinity. I can still remember the sensation of recently erupted hot juices collecting in my lap while students on either side of me flocked away in distaste. Far from experiencing shame, I felt a sly satisfaction, the power of the victim wreaking digestive revenge. I'd be sent down to the school nurse where I could lie on a cot until my Aunt Jin came to fetch me. Often at lunchtime, before I learned to barf at will, I'd beg to go home, swearing to look both ways when I was crossing the street, promising not to talk to strangers, even if they offered sweets. My teachers rebuffed every plaintive request, so I was doomed to remain. Fearful and anxious, undersized, fighting back tears. By the time I was 8, I learned to quit asking. I simply left when it suited me, and suffered the consequences later. What were they going to do, shoot me down in cold blood? The entrance to the Civic Center opened into a wide corridor that served as a lobby, currently undergoing renovations. File cabinets and storage units had been moved into the uncarpeted space. The walls were lined with panels of some unidentified wood. The ceiling was a low gridwork of acoustical tiles. Portions of the hallway were marked off with traffic cones strung together with tape, hand-lettered signs pointing to the current locations of several displaced departments. I found the sheriff's substation, which was small and consisted of several interconnecting offices that looked like the before photos in a magazine spread. Fluorescent lighting did little to improve the ambience, which was made up of a hodgepodge of technical manuals, wall plaques, glossy paneling, office machines, wire baskets, and notices taped to all the flat surfaces. The civilian clerk was a woman in her 30s, who wore running shoes, jeans, and an MIT sweatshirt over a white turtleneck. Her name tag identified her as Margaret Brine. She had chopped-off black hair, oval glasses with black frames, and a dusting of freckles under her powder and blush. Her teeth were big and square, with visible spaces between. I took out a business card and placed it on the counter. "I wonder if I might talk to Rafer Lamott?" She picked up my card, giving it a cursory look. "Will he know what this is about?" The coroner suggested I talk to him about Tom Newquist. Her gaze lifted to mine. "Just a minute," she said. She disappeared through a door in the rear that I assumed led into other offices. I could hear a murmur, and moments later Rafer Lamott appeared, shrugging himself into a charcoal-brown sport coat. He was an African-American in his 40s, probably 6 feet tall, with a caramel complexion, closely cropped black hair, and startling hazel eyes. His mustache was sparse, and he was otherwise clean-shaven. The lines in his forehead resembled parallel seams in a fine-grained leather. The sport coat he wore over black gabardine pants looked like cashmere. His shirt was pale beige, his tie a mild brown with a pattern of black paper clips arranged in diagonal lines up and down the length. He had my card in his hand, reading out the information in a slightly cocky tone. "Kinsey Milhone, P.I. from Santa Teresa, California. What can I help you with?" I could feel a prickly sensation at the back of my neck. His expression was noncommittal. Technically, he wasn't rude, but he certainly wasn't friendly, and I sensed from his manner he was not going to be much help. I tried a public smile, nothing with any sincerity or warmth. "Selma Newquist hired me. She has some questions about Tom." He regarded me briefly and then moved through the gate at one end of the counter.
"I have to be someplace, but you can follow me out. What questions?"
I had no choice but to trot along beside him as he headed down the hall toward a rear entrance. "She says he was upset about something. She wants to know what it was." He pushed the door open and passed through, picking up his pace in a manner that suggested mounting agitation. I caught the door as it swung shut and passed through right after him. I had to two-step to keep up. He pulled his car keys from his pocket as he descended the steps. He walked briskly across the parking lot and slowed when he reached a nondescript white compact car, which he proceeded to unlock. As he opened the car door, he turned to look at me.
"Listen, here's the truth, and no disrespect intended. Selma was always trying to pry into Tom's business, always pressing him for something just in case that poor guy had a fleeting thought of his own. The woman comes equipped with emotional radar, forever scanning her environment, trying to pick up matters of no concern to her. Repeat that, and I'll deny it so you can save your breath."
"I have no intention of repeating it. I appreciate your candor."
"Then you can appreciate this," he said. "Tom never said a word against her, but I can tell you from experience, she's exhausting to be around. Tom was a good guy, but now that he's gone, it's a relief not to have to see her. My wife and I never really wanted to spend time with Selma. We socialized when we had to out of our affection for him. If that sounds spiteful, I'm sorry, but that's the bottom line. My best advice to you is to leave the man in peace. He's barely cold in his grave, and she's trying to dig him up again."
"Could he have been worried about a case?" He glanced away from me then with a quick smile of disbelief that I'd pursued the point. I could see him rein himself in, struggling to be patient in hopes of getting rid of me.
"He had as many as 10, 15 files on his desk when he died. And no, you can't see them, so don't even ask."
"But nothing particularly distressing."
"I'm afraid I can't tell you what distressed Tom and what didn't."
"Who's taken over his workload?"
"I took some files, a new guy just hired on, and he's taking the rest. None of that information is for public consumption. I don't intend to compromise any ongoing investigation to satisfy Selma's morbid curiosity, so you can bag that idea."
"Do you think Tom had personal problems he didn't want her to know?"
"Ask somebody else. I don't want to say anything more about Tom."
"What's the big deal? If you'd give me some help, I'd be out of here," I said. By way of an answer, he got into the car and pulled the door shut. He turned the key in the ignition, pressing a button in the console. The car window slid down with a mild whir. When he spoke again, his tone was more pleasant.
Hey, this may sound rude, but do yourself a favor and let it drop, okay? Selma's a narcissist. She thinks everything's about her.
And this isn't? He pressed the button again, and the window slid back into place.
End of subject. End of Q&A. He put the car in reverse and backed out of the space, taking off with a little chirp as he threw the gear into first.
I could only stare after him. Belatedly, I sensed a stinging heat rise in my face. I raised a hand to my cheek as though I'd been slapped.
Chapter 5. I got in my car and headed back to Selma's, still completely unenlightened. I couldn't tell if Rafer knew something or if he was simply annoyed at Selma's hiring a private detective. Oddly enough, I found his rudeness more inspirational than daunting. Tom had died without much warning out on the highway, with no opportunity to clean up his business. For the moment, I was operating on the assumption that Selma's intuition was correct. I left my car out in front and crossed the lawn to the porch. Selma'd left a note taped to the door saying she'd be over at the church until noon. I tried the door, which was unlocked, so I didn't need the key she'd given me the night before. I let myself in, calling a hello as I entered in case Brant was on the premises. There was no call in response, though several lights in the house were on. I took a few minutes to move through the empty rooms. The house was one story, and most of the living space was laid out on one floor. Just off the kitchen, I found a set of stairs leading down to the basement. I flipped on the light and descended halfway, peering over the rail. I could see woodworking equipment, a washer and dryer, a hot water heater, and various odds and ends of furniture, including a portable barbecue and lawn chairs. A half-open door on the far wall led to the furnace room. There appeared to be ample storage. I'd nose around later, going through the cardboard boxes and built-in cabinets. I returned to Tom's office and sat down at his desk, wondering what secrets he might have kept from view. What I was looking for, if indeed there was anything, didn't have to be related to Tom's work. It could have been anything. Drink, drugs, pornography, gambling, an affair, an affinity for young boys, a tendency to cross-dress. Most of us have something we'd prefer to keep to ourselves. Or maybe there was nothing. I didn't like to admit it, but Rafer's attitude toward Selma was already having an effect. I'd resisted his view, but a small touch of doubt was beginning to stir. I abandoned Tom's desk, feeling restless and bored. So far, I hadn't turned up one significant scrap of paper. Maybe Selma was nuts, and I was wasting my time. I went out to the kitchen and poured myself a glass of water. I opened the refrigerator and stared at the contents while I pretended to quench my thirst. I closed the refrigerator door and checked the pantry. All the stuff she'd brought back from the store looked alarming. Artificial and imitation products of the Miracle Whip variety. There was a plate of what looked like raisin oatmeal cookies on the counter, with a note that said, "Help yourself." I ate several. I left the glass in the drain board and wandered into the hall. The phone seemed to ring every 15 minutes, but I let the machine pick up messages. Selma was much in demand, but it was all charity-related work. The church bazaar, a fundraising auction for the new Sunday school wing. I turned my attention to the master bedroom. Tom's clothes were still hanging in his half of the closet. I began to go through his pockets. I checked the top shelf, his shoe boxes, dresser drawers, his change caddy. I found a loaded Colt 357 Magnum in one bed table drawer, but there was nothing else of importance. The remaining content of the drawer was that embarrassing assortment of junk everyone seems to keep somewhere. Ticket stubs, matchbooks, expired credit cards, shoelaces. No dirty magazines, no sex toys. I looked under the bed, slid a hand along under the mattress, peeked behind picture frames, tapped with a knuckle across the walls in the closet, pulled up a corner of the rug, looking for hidden panels in the floor. In the master bath, I checked the medicine cabinet, the linen closet, and the hamper. Nothing leaped out at me. Nothing seemed out of place. For a while, in despair, I stretched out on the master bedroom floor, breathing in carpet fumes and wondering how soon I could decently quit. I went back into the den, where I finished going through the remaining junk on his shelves. Aside from feeling virtuous for cleaning out his desk drawers, I'd acquired absolutely no insights about Tom Newquist's life. I checked his credit card receipts for the past 12 months,
but neither his Visa or his MasterCard showed anything unusual. Most activity on the card could easily be matched to his desk calendar. For instance, a series of hotel and restaurant charges the previous February were related to a seminar he'd attended in Redding, California. The man was systematic. I gave him points for that. Any work-related charges to his telephone bill were later invoiced to his work and reimbursed accordingly. He didn't pad his account by so much as a penny. There was no pattern of outlandish expenses, and nothing to suggest any significant or unexplained outlay of cash. I heard a car pull into the drive. If this was Selma coming in, I'd tell her I was quitting so she wouldn't waste any more of Tom's hard-earned money. The front door opened and closed. I called a "Hello?" and waited for a response. "Selma, is that you?" I waited again. "The booger man?" This time I got a manly, "Yo," in response, and Selma's son, Brant, appeared in the doorway. He was wearing a red knit cap, a red sweatsuit, and pristine white leather Reeboks, with a white towel wrapped around his neck. Brant, at 25, was the kind of kid matronly housewives in the supermarket turned around and checked out in passing. He had dark hair and fierce brows over serious brown eyes. His complexion was flawless. His jaw was boxy, his cheeks as honed as if his face had been molded and shaped in clay first, and then carved out of flesh. His mouth was fleshy, and his color was good, a strong winter tan overlaid with the ruddy burn of snow glare and wind. His posture was impeccable, square shoulders, flat stomach, skinny through the hips. If I were younger, I might have whimpered at the sight of him. As it is, I tend to disqualify any guy that much younger than me, especially in the course of work. I've had to learn the hard way, as it were, not to mix pleasure with business. "My mom's not here yet?" he asked, pulling the towel from around his neck. He removed his knit cap at the same time, and I could see that his hair was curling slightly with the sweaty dampness of his workout. His smile showed straight white teeth. "Should be any minute. I'm Kinsey. Are you Brant?" "Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I should have introduced myself." I shook hands with him across the littered expanse of his father's desk. His palm was an odd gray. When he saw that I noticed, he smiled sheepishly. "That's from weightlifting gloves. I just came from the gym," he said. "I saw the car out front and figured you were here. How's it going so far?" "Well enough, I guess." "I better let you get back to it. Mom comes, tell her I'm in the shower." "Sure thing." "See you in a bit," he said. Selma got home at 12:15. I heard the garage door grumble up and then down. Within minutes, she'd led herself in the door that led from the garage into the kitchen. Soon afterward, I could hear the clattering of dishes, the refrigerator door opening and shutting, then the chink of flatware. She appeared in the den doorway, wearing a cotton pinafore-style apron over slacks and a matching sweater. "I'm making chicken salad sandwiches if you'd like to join us. You met Brant?" "I did. Chicken salad sounds great. You need help?" "No, no, but come on out and we can talk while I finish up." I followed her to the kitchen where I washed my hands. "You know what I haven't come across yet is Tom's notebook. Didn't he take field notes when he was working an investigation?" Surprised, Selma turned from the counter where she was putting together sandwiches.
"Absolutely. It was a little loose-leaf notebook with a black leather cover, about the size of an index card. Maybe a little bigger, but not much more than that. It must be around here someplace. He always had it with him."
She began to cut sandwiches in half, placing them on a platter with sprigs of parsley around the edge. "Every time I buy parsley, it turns to slime."
"Are you sure it's not there?" she asked.
"I haven't come across it. I checked his desk drawers and his coat pockets."
"What about his truck? Sometimes he left it in the glove compartment or the side pocket."
"Good suggestion. I should have thought of that myself." I opened the connecting door and moved into the garage. I skirted Selma's car and opened the door to the pickup on the driver's side. The interior smelled heavily of cigarette smoke. The ashtray bulged with cigarette butts buried in a shallow bed of ash. The glove compartment was tidy, bearing only a batch of road maps, the owner's manual, registration, proof of insurance, and gasoline receipts. I looked in the side pockets in both doors, looked behind the visors, leaned over and scanned the space under the bucket seats. I checked the area behind the seats, but there was only a small toolkit for emergencies. Aside from that, the interior revealed nothing. I slammed the driver's side door shut, glancing idly along the garage shelves in passing. I don't know what I thought I'd see, but there was no little black notebook within range. I returned to the kitchen. "Scratch that," I said. "Any other ideas?"
"I'll have a look myself later on today. He could have left the notebook at work, though he seldom did that. I'll call Rafer and ask him."
"Won't he claim the notes are department property?"
"Oh, I'm sure not," she said. "He told me he'd do anything he could to help. He was Tom's best friend, you know."
"But not yours," I thought. "One thing I'm curious about," I said tentatively. "The night he died, if he'd had any warning, he could have called for help if he'd had a radio. Why no CB in his truck? Why no pager? I know a lot of guys in law enforcement who have radios installed in their personal vehicles."
"Oh, I know. He meant to do that, but hadn't gotten around to it. He was always busy. I couldn't get him to take the time to drop it off and get it done. That's the sort of thing you tend to remember when there's no way to deal with it."
Brandt reappeared, wearing the blue uniform that identified him as an emergency medical technician for the local ambulance service. B. Newquist was embroidered on the left. His skin radiated the scent of soap, and his hair was now showered damp and smelled of ivory shampoo. I allowed myself one small, inaudible whine of the sort only heard by dogs. Neither Brandt nor his mother seemed to pick up on it. I sat at the kitchen table, just across from him, politely eating my sandwich while I listened to them chat. Midway through lunch, the telephone rang again. Selma got up.
"You two go ahead. I'll pick that up in Tom's den."
Brandt finished his sandwich without saying much, and I realized it was going to be my job to initiate conversation. "I take it Tom adopted you?"
"When I was 13, Brandt said. I guess you'd call him a birth father. Hadn't been in touch for years since my mom and him divorced. When she married Tom, he petitioned the court. I'd consider him my real dad, whether he adopted me or not."
"You must have had a good relationship." He reached for the plate of cookies on the counter, and we took turns eating them while we continued our conversation.
"The last couple of years we did. Before that, we didn't get along all that great. Mom's always been easygoing, but Tom was strict. He'd been in the army, and he came down real hard on the side of obeying rules. He encouraged me to get involved with Boy Scouts, which I hated. Karate and track, stuff like that. I wasn't used to having restrictions laid on me, so I fought back at first. I guess I did just about anything I could think of to challenge his authority. Eventually, he shaped up," he said, smiling slightly.
"How long have you been a paramedic?"
3 years. Before that, I didn't do much of anything. Went to school for a while, though I wasn't any great shakes as a student back then."
"Did Tom talk to you about his cases?"
"Sometimes. Not lately."
"Any idea why?"
Brandt shrugged. "Maybe what he was working on wasn't that interesting."
"What about the last 6 weeks or so?"
"He didn't mention anything in particular."
"What about his field notes? Have you seen those?" A frown crossed his face.
"His field notes?"
"The notes he kept," Brandt interrupted.
"I know what field notes are, but I don't understand the question. His are missing?"
"I think so. Or, put it this way, I haven't been able to lay hands on his notebook."
"That's weird. When it wasn't in his pocket, he kept it in his desk drawer or his truck. All his old notes he bound up in rubber bands and stored in boxes in the basement. Have you asked his partner? Might be at the office. I talked to Rafer once, but I didn't ask about the notebook because at that point I hadn't even thought to look."
"Can't help you on that one. I'll keep an eye out around here." After lunch, both Selma and Brandt took off. Brandt had errands to run before he reported for work, and Selma was involved in her endless series of volunteer positions. She'd posted a calendar on the refrigerator, and the squares were filled with scribbles for most days of the week. A silence settled on the house, and I felt a mild ripple of anxiety climb my frame. I was running out of things to do. I went back to the den and pulled the phone book out of Tom's top drawer. Given the size of the town, the directory was no bigger than a magazine. I looked up James Tennyson, the CHP officer who'd found Tom that night.
There was only one Tennyson, a James W., listed on Iroquois Drive in this same development. I checked my city map, grabbed my jacket and my handbag, and headed out to the car. Iroquois Drive was a winding roadway lined with two-story houses and an abundance of evergreens. Residents were apparently encouraged to keep their garage doors closed. Backyards in this section were fully fenced or surrounded by hedges, and I could see swing sets and jungle gyms, as well as above-ground swimming pools, still covered for the winter. The Tennysons lived at the end of the street, in a yellow stucco house with dark green shutters and a dark green roof. I parked out in front, snagging the morning paper from the lawn as I passed. I pushed the doorbell, but heard no reassuring ding-dong inside. I waited a few minutes and then tried a modest knock. The door was opened by a young woman in jeans with a sleeping baby propped against her shoulder. The child might have been 6 months old, sparse golden curls, flushed cheeks, flannel sleepers with feet, and a big diapered butt. "Mrs. Tennyson?"
"That's right."
"My name is Kinsey Milhone. I was hoping to have a word with your husband. I take it he's the one who works for the CHP?"
"That's right."
"Is he at work?"
"No, he's here. He works nights and sleeps late. That's why the doorbell's turned off.
You want to come in and wait? I just heard him banging around, so it shouldn't be long." "If you don't mind." I held up the newspaper. "I brought this in. I trust it's yours."
"Oh, thanks. I don't even bother until he's up. The baby gets into it and tears the whole thing to pieces if I'm not looking. Cat does the same thing. Sits there and bites on it, just daring me to get mad."
She moved aside to admit me, and I stepped into the entrance. Like Selma's, this house seemed overheated, but I may have been reacting to the contrast with the outside cold. She closed the door behind me.
"By the way, I'm Joe.
Your name's Kimmy?" "Kinsey," I corrected. "It was my mother's maiden name."
"That's cute," she said, flashing me a smile. "This is Brittany. Poor baby. We call her Bugsy for some reason. Don't know how that got started, but she'll never live it down."
Joe Tennyson was trim, with a ponytail and bangs, her hair a slightly darker version of her daughter's. She couldn't have been more than 21, and may have become a mother before she could legally drink. The baby never stirred as we proceeded to the kitchen. Joe put the newspaper on the kitchen table, indicating a seat. She moved around the room, setting up her husband's breakfast one-handed, while the baby slept on. I watched with fascination as she opened a fresh cereal box, shook some of the contents in a bowl, and fetched a spoon from the drawer, which she closed with one hip. She retrieved the milk carton from the refrigerator, poured coffee into three mugs, and pushed one in my direction.
"You're not in sales, I hope."
I shook my head and then murmured a thank you for the coffee, which smelled great. "I'm a private investigator. I have some questions for your husband about Tom Newquist's death."
"Oh, sorry. I didn't realize it was business, or I could have called him first thing. He's just fooling around. He likes to take his time in the morning because the rest of his day's so hectic. Let me see where he's at.
If you want any more coffee, help yourself. I'll be right back." During her absence, I took the opportunity to engage in a little sit-down observation. The house was untidy. I'd seen that in passing. But the kitchen was particularly disorganized. Counters were cluttered, the cabinet doors hung open, the sink piled with dishes from the last several meals. I thought the vinyl floor tile was gray with a dark mottled pattern, but on closer inspection, it turned out to be white, overlaid with an assortment of sooty footprints. I straightened up as she returned.
"He'll be right here. I didn't peg you for a detective. Are you local?"
"I'm from Santa Teresa."
"I didn't think you looked familiar. You should talk to Tom's wife. She lives in the subdivision, over in that direction, about 6 blocks on Pawnee. The Snooty Street, we call it."
"She's the one who hired me. You know her?"
"Uh-huh. We go to the same church. She's in charge of the altar flowers, and I help when I can. She's really good-hearted. She's the one who gave Bugsy her little christening dress. Here's James. I'll leave the two of you alone so you can talk."
I got to my feet as he entered the kitchen. James Tennyson was fair-haired, clean-cut, and slender, the kind of earnest young man you want assisting you on the highway when your fan belt goes funny or your rear tire's blown. He was dressed in civilian clothes,
jeans, a sweatshirt, and a pair of sheepskin slippers.
James Tennyson, nice to meet you.
Kinsey Milhone, I said as the two of us shook hands. I'm sorry to bother you at home, but I was over at the Newquist.